Item one, what happened this week, of course. Item number two, we go back to Beijing. And item number three, where old EV batteries go to die. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 14th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Yes, it is the middle of July. No, the economic news is not taking the summer off. So we have 6 minutes, maybe six and a half, to make it all make sense. Anna Swanson's at the New York Times. Amara Omokwe is at the Wall Street Journal. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
So, Anna, let me start with you. And given the inflation news this week, 3% year on year, down, by 2/3 from where it was a year ago. Unabashedly good news. Discuss.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of celebration of that report, and rightly so. It was a broad-based slowdown. We saw falling gas prices, but service prices also went down. Prices for cars, prices for shelter. The producer price fell yesterday. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, worker wages are staying steady. So, you know, it was a really good report. We've been burned before with positive inflation reports, but I think, you know, now it really looks like we're on the right path. It's just a question of how long that journey is going to take. And, you know, the Fed is probably still likely to increase interest rates again later this month. But after that, the picture looks a lot more uncertain to me.
Okay. Amara, let me ask you this, though. If inflation is coming down by so much, and it is, and this is the vibe session question, how come people still feel so lousy?
Well, I think inflation, it is coming down, but it is really still above the Fed's target. And you have to remember that people have been dealing with these price increases for 2 years now. And even when you look at wages, you know, we didn't have real wage growth until very recently, until the last 2 months or so. So people's wages haven't been keeping up with inflation, and they still have had to deal with these very steep price increases over the pandemic. And so, yes, things are improving, but that doesn't make people necessarily forget all the economic pain that they have been feeling for these past few years.
I don't want to get too deeply into tea leaf reading here, but it is worth pointing out that inflation at 3% is still a full 50% above where the Fed wants it to be. And thus we are, as Rafael Bostic says, in the hard part now, right? Because they're going to raise rates at least one more time, and maybe unemployment's going to start ticking up, and people are going to start to get antsier, I guess.
Yeah. So, I mean, definitely, you know, inflation is still clearly above target. You know, Powell says he's resolved to bring inflation closer to 2%, not 3%, and that stopping too soon would be a mistake. I think a lot of it gets into the question of, you know, how far behind is data lagging, and whether or not, you know, the Fed has already hiked 5% since last March. Has the full force of that already hit the economy, or how much of that is still to come? But yes, the Fed, you know, clearly knows that it has more work to do. But I do think it feels like we're headed in the right direction.
It's also worth pointing out here, Amara, that some prices are still going up, right? I mean, you did a piece on this for the Journal this week.
Some prices are still going up, and as we were talking about earlier, you know, some prices are still higher than where they were pre-pandemic. Right. And I think, as Anna was saying, it's just a matter of what the data is going to do. For instance, with core inflation, one thing that we're expecting is that the increases that we've seen in rent will start to abate, and we will see core inflation start to come down. So I think the Fed, it is the hard part, right? The Fed doesn't want to make a policy error, but you know, when you look across the inflation landscape, there's a lot of unevenness still.
All right. So I'm going to throw each of you a two-word phrase here. And Anna, you're the unlucky winner. You get to go first. soft landing. Possible, right? I mean, I think it's probably more possible now than it was, looks more likely now than it did even 6 months ago.
I agree. I mean, I think it does get into this question of lags and, you know, how much has the full force of previous rate hikes already hit the economy? How much is yet to come? You know, the issue with the lag is sort of when the Fed sees the new data, does it have enough time to adjust the controls on the plane so you land, you know, harder or softer? But yeah, so far so good, it looks like.
Amara, what do you think? Soft landing?
It certainly seems that way, right? And if you listen like the Biden administration this week, you had Lael Brainard out there talking about how, you know, we are seeing a cool down inflation in inflation without jobs destruction. And that is essentially the soft landing scenario. And so there was a lot of optimism after the CPI numbers this week that that is what we're going to get. It remains to be seen.
Yeah, Amara, let me stay with you actually on this one. And just since you brought up Lael Brainard and the political operation at the White House, this is going to be, well, is it the defining issue of the Biden campaign? Certainly one of them. And I guess my question is, do you think them leaning on the economy is going to work now as we head into 2024?
Well, I think it depends on whether or not we get that soft landing or not. And if we do get it, you know, to what extent do voters believe that it's a result of the Biden administration's policies, right? The Biden administration will talk about some of their industrial policy, their focus on, you know, lowering prescription drug prices. And it's just a matter of whether voters actually associate those policy moves with the reduction in inflation that we're seeing.
On a quick turn here, I want to talk about the trip that Secretary Yellen took to China, which I was lucky enough to go along with and had some time with the secretary. And I want your take on her answer to my question about whether or not she can actually put a floor under the spiraling is too hard, but certainly very tense U.S.-China relationship. And we should do your bona fides here. I mean, you've lived and worked over there. You've covered China for a while. So your take on whether this visit was successful, please.
She said, you know, the goal was to establish a floor in the relationship. And I think the relationship had really kind of atrophied in ways that are a little scary between the world's two biggest economies. During the pandemic, Chinese officials weren't really traveling abroad. There was balloon gate that ruptured relations. The Chinese defense secretary won't pick up the phone from his US counterpart. So establishing that kind of basic communication between the world's two largest economies is a really important goal. And I do think, you know, it seemed like there was some success with that. But there are a lot of other kind of risks or points of tension that are just waiting in the wings, whether, you know, future moves from the United States to make some restrictions to technology or whatever vitriol comes out of the next US election about China. So, you know, the question for me is whether any kind of engagement or action by the US can really reverse that broader trend, or are we just trying to keep things from going from bad to worse, you know, which in itself is also important,
Yeah,
right?
do you think it can reverse the trend though? Quickly, you got like 20 seconds.
I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of current running in the other direction. You know, we've really just kind of started this trend toward decoupling, and you know, it looks like that's the way that the world is going toward fewer connections between the US and China, not more.
Anna Swanson at the New York Times, Samara Mokwe at the Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street this Friday in the middle of July, kind of a tepid end to a quite hot week. We will have the details when we do the numbers. We were talking, Anna and I, about the Chinese economy yet to come, what that's going to mean for the rest of the world. But back in the mid-90s, when my wife and I were living in Beijing, China had really just started the epic growth spurt that would make it the second biggest economy in the world. And when we were there was this vegetable stand we used to go to just down the block from our apartment. It was called Jenny Lou's, basically just a couple of tarp-covered 2x4s and a dirt floor, bare light bulbs, where a 26-year-old woman from Hubei province, Jenny Lou, sold vegetables mostly to Westerners like us. We left China, my wife and I, in 1997.
This is new.
And when I went back in 2005 on a reporting trip for Marketplace, I went looking for Jenny Lou's.
All right, so let me see if I can get back into. Yeah, so here you go. Oh, this is. Wow.
Big chunks of my old neighborhood, Sanlitun, had been bulldozed. They were going to build a luxury hotel and a big entertainment complex. And the place where Jenny Liu's vegetable stand used to be, it was just a construction site.
I'm not even sure what's going to be in this one.
Turned out, though, that she had done well for herself. She had 8 stores selling mostly imported goods. I asked her, and again, this is back in 2005, how she had done it even as the whole Chinese economy was changing underneath her.
Need someone to learn, make a service, make a fool. It's a way to know the shit. Need someone to learn.
Knowing what your customers want, she tells me. That's what helped her turn a vegetable stand into a multi-million-dollar supermarket business in just 8 years. That is China. And that is Marketplace.
That was then, 2005. So when I was back in Beijing last week covering Secretary Yellen's visit, I went for a bit of a walkabout.
All right, so I'm going to take a left up here.
It was early, like 6:30 on a Saturday morning. Nothing was open.
Jenny Liu's. There you go. Same place. Son of a gun.
I stuck my nose up to the doors. Had a good look inside.
Wow, look at that. She's got meats and cheeses in there. Lots of inventory. Shopping carts, which is funny. Chips. And then a whole wall of freezer space.
Over the past 30 years, hundreds of millions of people have had their lives changed by the way China's economy has grown and changed. Jenny among them, a tarp-covered vegetable stand to what you got to call a high-end supermarket chain. Now, though, that economy is changing again.
Man, I hope she's doing well. I hope she's doing well.
We are going to get, just as an indicator, China's second quarter economic growth numbers on Monday. Inflation, as I said on Tuesday, has been the economic byword this week. We learned consumer prices were up 0.2% in June from May. Anna was talking about that. Producer prices up just 0.1%. And this morning we learned imported products actually got less expensive in June. Import prices were down 0.2% June from May, more than 6% lower than a year ago. So Marketplace's Justin Ho spent his day figuring out how deflation at the import level might affect inflation at the consumer level.
A big part of the import price index is the cost of imported energy, and it is a lot cheaper than it was a year ago.
A lot of this is driven by a 37% drop in the import prices for fuels year over year.
That's Megan Schoenberger, senior economist at KPMG. She says we have to keep in mind that oil prices peaked around this time last year. So now they're going to look cheap by comparison. But in the last few months, other imports have gotten cheaper too.
Consumer goods, automotives, capital goods, they're all coming down and softening quite a bit.
That's because demand for imported goods has been falling. Mary Lovely is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. She says, look at what's going on with Chinese manufacturers.
Their sales slumped by 12% on an annual basis in June. So that's pretty bad for them.
And when demand falls, so do prices.
Just looking at U.S. imports from China, prices declined by more than 1% in June, following a very large decline in May.
That's having the biggest impact on the materials American manufacturers use to make things.
Chemicals, metals, and more processed inputs that firms use to produce.
That's Robert Johnson, an economics professor at Notre Dame. He says those cheaper materials will have a domino effect.
Lowered prices for imported inputs are going to show up as lower prices for domestically produced goods, like showing up in the producer price index.
And after some time, those reductions, Johnson says, will eventually show up in consumer prices too. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Take it out of the car, put it in, cable it up, and it's ready to go.
Yeah, I'm going to leave that to my mechanic. Thank you very much. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 113 today, 0.3%, 34,509. The NASDAQ down 24 points, about 0.2%, 14,113. The S&P 500 off 4 points, about a 0.1%, 45.5. For the week, the Dow up 2.3%, the NASDAQ up 3.3%, the S&P 500 up 2.4%. Justin was just telling us about how import prices are trending down, so let's take a look at some of the biggest U.S. importers. Big box stores tend to top that list. Walmart up 0.3% today. Home Depot picked up 0.6%. Target off the mark by 1.4% on this Friday. Bonds down. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 3.82%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. $886 billion is a lot of money, even in as big an economy as this one is. So we pause here to spend a few moments on something known in Washington, D.C. as the NDAA. To us civilians, it's the National Defense Authorization Act, which, just like it sounds, authorizes how our national defense dollars can be spent. It's one of those must-pass pieces of legislation that, despite the epic dysfunction in the American Congress, always does pass with plenty of votes from both sides of the aisle. The House passed its version this morning, although pretty much along party lines, which explains, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports now from Washington, the partisan morass that national defense is about to fall into.
The National Defense Authorization Act is always a big bill with hundreds of amendments and some tough negotiations over top-line numbers, balancing defense and non-defense spending.
And then there are controversies over different weapon systems, over which members' districts are going to get contracts or not. But this year is a little bit unusual.
Matthew Koenig runs the Atlantic Council Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security. Sure, there are things in the bill like a 5.2% raise for service members and Pentagon employees, but also
there is more debating over these controversial social issues and whether the Congress will allocate funding to the Pentagon for things like diversity and diversity training, travel out of state for abortions and things like that.
These amendments focused on hot-button cultural issues are likely a poison pill which will tank the bill in the Senate. So, says Kylan Hunter, a senior political scientist at the Rand Corporation,
it's going to open up a long series of deliberations and negotiations that have the potential to really delay this process.
This is all ideally supposed to be done by October, but if it's not,
there won't be any new innovation. There won't be any new advancement. We are, in a holding pattern for acquiring new gear and technologies that could be essential to our national security.
And, says Hunter, this messy process sends a bad message to our allies and people who might be considering serving in the military. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
There's news of cryptocurrency this week that we want to tell you about, but for which some background is required. There's a cryptocurrency company called Ripple Labs. It sells a token, which is kind of a coin, but not really a coin, but that's not important right now. That token is called XRP, and Ripple sells XRP on public crypto exchanges. The Securities and Exchange Commission saw that and said, wait, that's a violation of securities laws, and sued Ripple. A judge this week said in that case, no, it's not a violation to trade XRP on public exchanges, but the judge ruled XRP tokens were being offered as investment contracts to institutional investors, and he said that that is a violation of securities laws. Crystal clear, right? Well, no, I get that. But the point is, both the regulators and the crypto guys are now claiming victory, and this, then, is a prime example of how hard it is going to be to regulate crypto. Marketplace's Lily Jamali takes it from there.
Much of the legal wrangling in the crypto space comes down to whether particular digital assets can be classified as securities. And regulators ask questions to see if they are, says Timothy Massett, former chair of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
Are the developers still involved? Does someone have administrative keys or powers that could affect the value of the token?
If so, then that asset falls in the securities basket, and that theoretically puts said digital asset and the company behind it within the SEC's authority. But Massett says regulators often end up having to sue to get information to make the call.
There's nothing that mandates disclosures about particular tokens today.
Massett argues crypto companies should have to make more disclosures up front before a token ever makes it to a trading platform near you. Despite disagreement over what new regulations should look like, Sheila Warren, CEO of the Crypto Council for Innovation, says they're necessary.
Sophisticated and mature actors in any industry understand that being within a regulatory perimeter provides comfort and security to users and consumers, and that matters.
But much of the regulatory perimeter that crypto falls into was drafted almost a century ago, says Stephen Pally, a partner with the law firm Brown Rudnick.
The Securities Act and the Exchange Act, those are from the 1930s. Like, Congress didn't anticipate digital assets that could be traded electronically.
Fair to say those rules aren't aging too well in the digital era, Pally says.
Imagine having interstates and cars, but having a 10-mile-an-hour speed limit. That wouldn't make much sense.
I'll agree, the laws are due for some updates. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
If we're going to meet the Biden administration's renewable energy goals, which, remember, is 100% renewable by 2035, we've got to solve a couple of problems. More than a couple, actually, but one step at a time, right? Problem number one for us right now is that electricity demand is highest when the sun goes down. We all get home from work and crank the AC, which is also inconveniently when solar panels stop generating energy. Problem number two, electric vehicle batteries suck up a whole lot of resources to produce, but they stop holding their full charge after a few years. So we've got high demand for stored energy and a big supply of old batteries. You see where I'm going with this? From KCRW here in Los Angeles, Kaylee Wells takes us to a solar farm that's trying to solve those two problems at once.
Rachel Harper shows me a trailer that holds 24 old EV batteries stacked one on top of another. There are dozens of these trailers right next to countless rows of solar panels soaking in the harsh, unmitigated desert sun. Each battery still has 60 to 70% of its original charge capacity.
So it's pretty straightforward. I mean, yeah. It's pretty simple, like take it out of the car, put it in, cable it up, and it's ready to go.
Harper works for the company that owns the solar farm, B2U Storage Solutions, about 50 miles north of Los Angeles. The used car batteries, 1,300 of them in total, are hooked up to wires using what juice they do have left to store energy the solar panels generate during the day. The idea is the company can then sell solar power back to the grid in the evening, when Californians need it most.
You know, this is exactly the type of market-based solutions that we're looking for.
Yaman Nani is a manager of LA's Department of Water and Power. So an EV driver might decide to replace their battery once their car can't drive as far as it used to. That's happening more every year, and Nani sees the potential.
As more and more EV batteries become available to the secondary market, I think we're going to see more and more of this.
B2U Storage Solutions makes money at this because solar energy that gets stored is more profitable, and LA is willing to pay the price to meet its ambitious renewable energy goals. Here's B2U's co-founder Freeman Hall.
So that, of course, then would lead to much higher prices in periods when the sun is not shining, but where the demand for power is still high.
So B2U gets old batteries from automakers like Nissan and Honda that might have been replaced by warranty or that were in old leased cars. The batteries get a second life for 5 or 6 years, storing solar power. And once they're completely dead, they get recycled. But there aren't a lot of solar farms storing energy like this just yet. It hasn't happened at scale, and that's partly because there just aren't that many old EV batteries out there. Hull points out a decade ago, car makers sold far fewer EVs, just tens of thousands annually.
Now we're selling over 2 million EVs a year, and that is a number that's rising rapidly, of course.
Now, Hull owns a solar storage company, so of course he says this is a great idea. But some energy researchers think it's a great idea, too. like Anthony Tong, who used to test battery technology for the Department of Energy and the California Energy Commission. He says it's way better than other storage options, including the most common technology today, hydroelectric.
Hydro doesn't really meet the requirement because the controllability of this is very limited. The capability of building new sites for environmental reasons are also very limited nowadays.
Tong was so convinced by his research and testing that he's since founded a company specializing in using old batteries for energy storage, just like B2U.
So actually, the BioEndo options for storage today is the lithium-ion batteries.
Lithium-ion, which happens to be exactly the kind of battery that they're putting in those electric vehicles. And since they're so expensive and the metals inside are difficult to mine, it's cheaper and more eco-conscious to use those batteries that have already been produced. In Lancaster, California, I'm Kaylee Wells for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, we've mentioned a couple of times this week that earnings season was set to kick off today, and indeed, it did. Big Wall Street banks led the way, J.P. Morgan first among equals, about which this little tidbit. You remember when JPM bought up First Republic back in May after the March spasm in regional banking? Well, here's the payoff for Jamie Dimon et al. J.P. Morgan reported earnings per share today of $4.75, $4.75. Of that, the bank says 91 cents, or give or take 20%, was from the First Republic acquisition. All right, we got to go. No time for any context today. I went too long in the rap and too much of me talking to begin with, I guess. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager of Marketplace Worldwide Productions. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you on Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a nice weekend, all right? This is APM.